This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
We bring you our open conversation today. And you know what? My guest is an interesting person today. He has a long-standing career in the financial services sector. And of course, he's one of our thought leaders on issues around the economy, investments and innovation for better ease of doing business across all of our society. And of course, some of you know him as Mr. Post Office, and that is none other than the former CEO of the South African Post Office, Mark Barnes. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I see the cape is rubbing off on you nicely, but anyway, you are a boy of Mpumalanga, so I'm not surprised at all at that lovely greeting. Mark, I mean, I think we need more time. We definitely need 2 hours, but guess what? We just have 50 minutes, so we're going to make the most of it and, you know, just run through it as much as possible. You know, once a person moves out of the public eye, we often think that they're in retirement, but I know you are still fit as a fiddle. So what have you been up to since you left the post office?
Yeah, thanks. And thanks. Hello to everybody. And thanks for your interest in my life. I've been busy. You know, I mean, one of my major focuses is to raise a fund to invest capital in the real economy, KISBE SME Fund, which thankfully now is coming into its first capital just around the corner. So that's good. I remain engaged on one or two government discussions, but nothing that's going to result in an appointment at this point in time or anything of that nature. And, of course, I'm still one of the biggest shareholders in Purple Group, which owns Easy Equities, which is a huge platform that makes equity investing easy for individuals. And it's really growing like mad. So I write a couple of columns. I'm supposed to be under contract writing a book, and I've got children, and I'm old. So, I mean, I'm a busy tortoise, you know?
So that takes up a lot of your time. But just tell me about this interesting way you describe yourself as. I mean, you've just talked about, you know, equity funds, growing a fund here that's coming to fruition. And, I mean, you say you are a financial justice warrior. What the hell is that?
Well, you know, I think that we've got a lot of things to talk about in our country, about fair market value, about participation in value, about capital allocation, about where we're spending our money, about what the returns are and whether they're all measured in cash, and you know, about the establishment, if you will, versus the real economy. It's been a bugbear of mine, you know, for a decade now. You know, how do we involve the entire population as participants in the economy? What's the role of the state? How do we allocate risk capital into out of the established listed capital markets of the stock exchange and the bond markets and into the real economy, which is accessing capital at a punitive rate at the moment in the informal markets? And so I think there's a huge opportunity for us to start relooking at the allocation of capital in this country. And let me say it differently. If indeed we don't do that, then we've got a huge continuation of economic inequality, which is going to be pervasive, which you know, is the foundation of continuing poverty and unemployment. And then we have ourselves in a polarized economy, which is going to end up fighting with each other. So these things aren't just virtuous and valuable. They're necessary. We've got to a point where it is necessary for us to think about all of us.
Yeah,
instead of some of us.
In fact, Mark, last year at a webinar that you were participating on with the CDE, if I'm not mistaken, you made an interesting remark which almost shocked some people when you said, if you want to learn business, do not go stand in Sandton City. Go stand in the intersection in the main streets of Alexandra. I mean, how dare you snub Sandton after all these years?
Well, you know, there's a post office in Alexandra, which is the first time, to be honest, that I went right into it. And when I got there, I noticed that there was grass growing in the gutters. So I climbed on the roof, much to everyone's dismay. They were taking photographs of me doing that. And I found an ecosystem up there where you had a broken air conditioner trickling water down into a gutter that was filled with dust. And that formed the soil which was the foundation for a plant.
Wow.
So we tidied that up. But as a consequence, I spent the day there. And I have since then, you know, in my role as CEO of the post office, been to a lot of informal settlements because we are required by law to provide everyone in this country with an address. So
absolutely.
Whether it's in Diepsloot and you're on the corner of grid 146F and this street, we have to provide you an address. That's your entitlement as a citizen of South Africa, or as a resident in South Africa, for that matter. And so I've been in and I've had a look. And if you stand at the main business intersection of Alexander, and if you look across the highway, you can see Sandton over there.
Yeah.
I can tell you it's much quieter in Sandton than it is there. I would argue that there is real business happening between informed, competent business people who know the price at the margin of goods in supply and demand, who are trading, but who never really get to escape velocity and move out of a trading environment into a bigger established business that can attract serious capital. And I'm arguing that we need to go there. They're not coming here. We need to go there, and we need to understand the fundamentals of business as they are happening on the ground. During COVID, a lot of home improvements, a lot of money was spent in people's houses, in their natural environments, in their places where they live, because they couldn't venture out.
Mm.
And you start seeing companies like bed companies, providers of basic glass, all of these companies starting to have a different focus and a different life on a different economy. Now, I would argue that that's where the real returns are. And there's an old adage in business, Lucora, when you see lots of buildings going up, you have to wonder whether money would be better spent in client acquisition strategies rather than using excess capital to build, edifices to your past success. I would argue that Sandton is a picture of the past. Alexander is a picture of the future. We need to find a middle ground.
And I mean, talking about finding that middle ground, Mark, there seems to be a lot of obsession with formalization. And I keep raising this issue where, I mean, even some of the political parties in their manifestos, including the ruling party, would talk about how they need to formalize even the informal. To your mind, how should we characterize the informal economy and really put some focus and make sure that there are policy shifts in attempting to understand it properly in its context, but also, as you are saying, going to its context to make sure that you deliver some level of capitalization to that sector, but at a far less rate than what you characterized earlier, almost as saying it is crippling rates to which they are accessing capital at the moment.
Yeah, so there are businesses that are borrowing money month to month, okay? They wait for a purchasing order, they go and discount that to someone, they get charged, I don't know, 3% a month. Okay, you do the compound interest on 3% a month, you get to 42, 43, whatever it is, percent. Okay. Now, if they are still able to make a profit with that cost of capital, imagine how they could grow if you reduce that cost of capital to just, say, prime plus 2, which would be below 10%. Okay. And so people don't want to go into that risk profile because they don't understand. Well, I would argue that if you develop an ecosystem of understanding around real businesses, like, for example, making sure that, their accounts are up to date, that they're registered for tax, that they're compliant with all the laws, that they've got adequate insurance and systems and all of those kinds of things, you start creating a middle class.
Yeah.
Okay. You start drawing people up from a survival cash-to-cash economy, and in so doing you create a middle class, and in so doing you start creating tax base which can be plowed back into those very same communities which are producing the economic activity. And so we have to take lazy, fully priced capital out of formal markets and put it to work in the real economy. That means you have to take a bit of risk. That means we have to develop an understanding.
Yeah.
That means we have to go beyond the covenants and standard measurements that are typical of commercial banking, and we have to get involved and get our hands dirty. But the rewards will be there for sure, and people have discovered this around the world. We're not unique, and the risks can be understood and mitigated. And the biggest risk of all, Lucona, is if we don't do it. Imagine if we don't.
Now, I suppose that is a very, very big risk. And I mean, Mark, one of the things that has been quite interesting in the South African space is when we talk microfinance, we immediately have in mind loan sharks. We don't seem to have a developmental approach to microfinance, which of course would be part of and parcel of those offerings perhaps that could be taken to that level of economy. I mean, do you see any work being done in this space?
Yeah, well, you can't go out to dinner in my circle without talking about SMEs or SMMEs, okay, because it's very fashionable. But very little money is hit the ground, okay? And so I see a world in 5 years' time where 20% of invested assets, pension fund assets, you know, asset managers have invented and understood a new asset class, which is the developing economy. Now, you need mixtures of capital. You might even need some philanthropic capital as a base in this. You might need schemes like National Treasury coming to the party. You might need equity capital in a mix with debt capital. What you can't have is microfunding as the only source of capital, because it might keep you going, but it will never let you grow. You need space. You need to be able to breathe. You need to be able to have deferred returns, and so that you can build a business when you've got predictable demand. Anyway, I mean, these things are self-evident. The issue is this, is that people haven't had to go there.
Yeah.
They make a very good living not going there. But they don't realize that the threat that builds up,
if you don't go there,
at 30% and so on, is going to undermine their established businesses. They will not have clients one day.
Yeah. Mark, let us just take a quick break and I'll be back with you shortly.
Power Talk with Lukhona Mguni. Call Lukhona on 0861-987-000.
And of course, you can tweet me at Lukhona Mguni, hashtag Power Talk. But that line is now open to you if you want to be part of this conversation. And I know some might say, yeah, we want to know about post office. We will get there at a later stage. Let us stay with the interesting musings around, I mean, financial markets and issues of the economy with my guest here. Of course, former post office former post office CEO, Mark Barnes. And of course, that line is 0861-987-000 if you want to be part of the conversation. Mark, I'm not going to give away your age, but I mean, for someone who matriculated in the early 1970s, no doubt, I mean, in your career as an investment banker and a finance person now into fund management, over the years, you have seen the changing nature of capital formation in our country, because this is also part and parcel of a complex and important conversation that we should be having. How would you say capital has changed over the past 40 years and lessons we should be mindful of into the future? And I know you've started giving us some of those lessons. I mean, when you talk about invested assets, probably they will start looking and trying to understand the informal economy, because they'll understand the cost of not doing that. But insofar as looking at capital formation in our country, what would you say are some of the shifts that have happened and we should take them into account as we try and talk about the future and the nature of our economy?
Yeah, there's been less shift than you would have expected.
Yeah.
One of the challenges is that things have stayed the same, although things are very different.
Mm.
And I think you have to introduce, you know, the role of the state. You have to introduce, you know, what role does it have in the economy? What impact do SOEs and their funding and so on have on the economy? But the established economy, the listed companies on the stock exchange, the major chains that are trading out there, I don't think their capital construct has changed very much. I think their client base has obviously changed, their product mix has changed, but these are very well capitalized companies. Now, I would argue this: the raising of capital is going to change substantially from those markets and be disintermediated by the modern world. And give you something, you know, you get things like Bitcoin coming up. Well, why does Bitcoin have a place? It has a place because currencies, money, as we know it, you know, is now the subject really of central banks around the world and their wishes and requirements for their country in the context of a global trading environment.
Mm.
So, you know, fiat currency, which is money, is now being managed, if you like. Okay, they just put $1.9 trillion into the American economy. Quantitative easing, in my view, doesn't make things more valuable; it just makes them cheaper.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of if you, not manipulation, but there's a lot of control and guidance about the relative values of money across the world, whether you're import or export driven. Now, the social media that rules our lives and that we're all connected to allows us access to instant information. And so people start looking at alternatives, alternative ways to deliver things, alternative ways to order things, alternative ways to pay for things, alternative currencies that can't be meddled with. And so you have dominating the stock markets of the world in terms of value today, very different companies. General Motors used to be the biggest company in the world. It had a turnover bigger than South Africa's GDP. You know, Tesla is now bigger than Toyota. Zoom is bigger than the top 7 airlines in the world. And so you're moving towards a client acquisition strategy defining value rather than earnings defining value. Now, I'm not saying this is all a good thing, but if you look at the top 5 companies that dictate the Standard & Poor's Index in New York, they're social media companies, if I could call them. They're technology companies. They're Apple, they're Amazon, they're Facebook. Do these companies make anything? Can you eat anything that they make? The answer is no.
Yeah. Okay. But they have some value to them, and then people are backing that value they give.
Yeah, but the value then is going to manifest in what they've replaced. Okay, so you have to start saying, okay, do banks have a life going forward? Well, not unless they change their model substantially.
Okay? Yeah.
Because you're going to have collective capital raising, you're going to have people that now can list a company called a SPAC, which has got no purpose at all. It goes out and says, listen, I don't know what I'm going to do with your money, but can you give it to me, please? Okay. And so and those things are all going to overshoot and undershoot, and they're high velocity traders and all of these kinds of things. What those messages have in them is that traditional allocation of capital has changed forever. Individuals count. Individuals can add themselves together and become a funding or a protesting force in economics. And so the dissemination of information has empowered people, and it's not without risk. Okay, so the capital allocation models are no longer the preserve of some stuffy old men in cigars and cups.
Yeah. Now, I mean, talking about that, it seems you are introducing a need of agility that has innovation at the heart of it, Mark.
Yeah.
And how do we, in our current context, I mean, we often lament the education system, this and that, the funding opportunities. How do we break through and ensure that we innovate to keep up with these times that you are talking about?
You know, someone said the other day that we need a whole bunch of entrepreneurs. We don't. Entrepreneurs are natural species. You can't breed them.
I like that.
You can't make an entrepreneur. They sort of pretty much DNA'd when they get born, if you like.
Yeah.
How do we get there? We listen more than we talk. Okay. You know, I sit and listen to my children and ask them for their view of all of the stuff, because mine is prejudiced and uninformed and not open. Okay. And so we start, instead of dictating, we start following. We start standing behind trends and trying to understand them and join in on them and start realizing that we have to be in the stream rather than damming the stream or diverting the stream. And, you know, I don't know what the answer is except to be aware and be beyond tolerant, be interested in what might truly be emerging. Start understanding trends below the surface. You know, you look at pharmaceutical companies, another big growth area. You know, you've got to start understanding what drives them. And, you know, this longevity, we're all going to live forever and so on. And so all of those things, I would argue, you have to listen to and absorb rather than stick to your concept of value. Which is still controlled by very, very, very few people in the world.
Absolutely. Mark, I'm just going to take a short break so that we do news headlines, and then we will be back and continue with this conversation. And of course, if you want to be part of that conversation, the line is 0861-987-000, but it is 11:30 here on Power Talk.
Power Talk with Lukhona Mguni, weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Power 98.7.
And of course, to be part of this conversation I'm having with Mark Barnes, former CEO of the South African Post Office. That line is 0861-987-000. And of course, you can tweet me at Lukhona Mnguni, hashtag Power Talk. Mark, I just want us to shift gears a bit now and look at something that you have also, you know, applied yourself to. And this is the question around our public debt as a country, which has been a big talking point. And I mean, if you look at the national budget or you're hearing from the rating agencies, they keep talking about this fiscal consolidation. And it's such a phrase in the hallways of Treasury. What are some of the conversations we might be missing when we talk about South Africa's public debt?
Yeah, I wouldn't regard myself as an expert anymore on that sort of stuff. But
no, of course.
There are a couple of factors. First of all, you know, we've got a very deep and liquid capital market. So we are able to, we have always been able to issue capital at a reasonable price. We haven't been doing that much lately. You know, I don't know what the real price of hard currency capital might be into this very different balance sheet that we've got now. But you know, because capital goes where capital is welcomed and gets the right return. A lot of financing has been taken off balance sheet, as you were. If you look at some of the capital that's been raised, for example, to go into SOEs, that's essentially been raised out of the banking system against a guarantee from National Treasury. It has been raised by issuing bonds into the international financial markets. Now, when you think through that and look where the source of the funding is, the source of the funding is really retail depositors, us. We put money on deposit with banks, which then lend it out against you know, National Treasury guarantees, and we are essentially then funding the government at a much lower cost than they would have to issue paper in the capital market. That would be the first point.
Yeah.
The second point is that, you know, a lot of our state-owned entities, Transnet, Eskom, grew their and developed their entities by issuing their own capital. Okay, and so Eskom bonds and Transnet bonds were highly traded, highly sought after capital instruments. There was no taxpayers' money involved in building Eskom the first time around, because we had a predictable set of cash flows in a utility with a known demand curve and a known cost of supply. And in that world, okay, you get a very different balance sheet on government than you do where no one will directly put capital into state-owned entities. Okay, and so you have a state intervention which costs money and impacts on the sovereign balance sheet and ultimately impacts on the rating that the country has. And our capital gets more and more expensive as we show less and less capability of deploying it into a predictable and sufficiently term adjusted return. And so I would argue that you're in a, if you look forward to our sources of capital, they're going to be very different from where they might have been up to now, because we the state's needing to stand behind a lot of it. In the private sector, though, capital is still available, and there is enthusiasm about South Africa and justified so.
Yeah.
And our exchange rate and our interest rates are still very attractive from a international perspective because we've got a deep capital market. But I would argue that that's a trader's market, not an investor's market. We need foreign direct investment that's come here to stay. We don't need people getting
just trading
yield enhancement out of our capital instruments.
And I mean, Mark, talking about this idea where private sector capital probably still strong, I mean, I remember the first investment summit the president went to. I mean, he stood up then boldly pronounced to the nation, the investment strike is over. I mean, I remember a conversation I had with Kesko Vardia. He says, well, there was really never an investment strike. I mean, where do you stand in that debate whether, you know, capital has not been deployed to the degree that it could have been at this stage by the private sector itself, giving notions of an investment strike?
I don't have the numbers to fight that one way or another, but I would say this, that there's a lot of hesitancy and uncertainty, okay? And so, I mean, you know, to bring out the most obvious one, the expropriation of land without compensation, that brings into question how you fund the agricultural sector. It brings into question all sorts of things, you know, and prescribed assets and all of these uncertain overrides which could be imposed on a market economy create a situation where you don't know whether market principles are going to survive. And the private sector, you know, makes decisions based on the assumption that fair market value will prevail, that supply and demand will determine price, that there'll be no interventions in those natural forces. And when there's a concern that there might well be interventions or overrides or imposed, you know, ways of doing business or ways of owning assets, then that does produce a hesitance, which translates into a premium that's required for the risk.
And of course, I mean, talking about
projects.
Talking about prescribed assets, I mean, which is a policy discussion that doesn't seem to end or take off, whichever will happen to it. There is also this idea that government is trying to make investment into social infrastructure fashionable. Do you think there is uptake of that and the business case for investors to come on board insofar as social infrastructure is concerned is actually coming through and at the required rate to assist government, particularly with the thinning fiscal space for them to fund and capitalize some of this social infrastructure?
I think, you know, infrastructure is an imperative. I think people are not debating whether infrastructure spending and maintenance and, you know, and growing production capacity is needed. Now, I don't think anyone argues that point. The point is who's in charge of it.
Okay? Mm.
So you take prescribed assets. I don't have a problem with prescribed assets per se. If you ask me to take 10% of my money and invest it in infrastructure which and give me a 7% yield, I'd say that's a fair piece of my portfolio. I don't find it unattractive. The debate is who is making the investment decisions? Who is going to invest that money? Is there going to be anything corrupt about it? Are there going to be any leaks? I mean, take something like toll roads. I think toll roads is a virtuous construct, you know, but did all of the capital that was ever raised go into the creation of toll roads? Or is the pricing? All of those secondary questions are what make the debate interesting. But as a matter of principle, do we have to have infrastructure? Of course we do. Let me give an example. If the railways aren't working, then all of the goods have to be transported by road.
Yeah.
Once you, if you drive down to Cape Town, as I've done more than once recently, it's just trucks, trucks, trucks. And you think, hell, the economy must be booming. It's not the economy that's booming. It's the railway that's not working.
Mm.
Okay. And so the roads are not made to bear that kind of volumes of traffic. And so in the longer term, you know, you have to pay a price for the decay of sensible economic assets that are not maintained. So there's no question but that we have to invest in infrastructure and maintenance. The question is, how do we make sure that it goes to the right places in the right time, and do we harvest the dividend by, you know, making the cost of doing business and the ability to do business competitively, available to our investors? And so, you know, what discussions are there around, you know, should we be the low-cost producer of steel? Are we the low-cost producer? Should we import substitute? Should we? All of those kinds of debates need to be had with a market driving force behind them. If they are overridden by policy, which is not at fair market value, then that makes fair market value capital hesitate.
Yeah, I'm in conversation with Mark Barnes, of course, if you've just tuned in here on Power Talk this morning. And of course, you can dial in on 0861-987-000 if you have any thoughts or questions on the issues that he's raising. It is just about 17 minutes to 12, so we still have a bit of time with him. I mean, Mark, the last comments you are making, and I mean, dovetailing with the idea of building a capable state, no doubt this rests on ethical leadership, as you are saying, but also a visionary leadership. What would you say are some of the key anchoring values and tenets to your own leadership philosophy that you have relied on over the years?
Wow. I keep learning, you know.
Student of life.
You know, I went to the post office to teach, and I ended up learning.
Yeah.
I think, first of all, you have to realize that a team is made up of different players with different skills, and you have to celebrate the differences that are required.
Mm.
The guy who scores the goal wouldn't get there if the backs weren't defending his goal and passing him the ball. And but if you're a back, you're not going to score goals. Mm. Get over it, okay? But if you're a forward in soccer, if the backs don't give you the ball, you're not going to score goals either. So the first issue is common purpose, a definition of common purpose. In sport, you don't have to debate that. It's to win the game, to score the goal, to sink the putt. In South Africa, we don't have common purpose, in my view. Okay, so you have to create common purpose, which allows you to celebrate the differences between people, and it allows you to embrace people with different skills and inputs that are necessary to create a competitive mixture of capability.
Mm.
We're running separately here. We're not running together. When we seek advice in this country, we don't seek it amongst ourselves. We go and hire very expensive international consultants who, in my view, have no real interest in the prosperity of our country. And so, in so doing, we don't create the possibility of economic dignity amongst our people. We pay, to get by. And I think the time has come for us to embrace one another and to recognize how skills and abilities and attitudes and cultures and things need to pass through a very porous membrane so that we can learn from one another and create. You know, let me summarize it in a tweet that I sent out once. We better start loving our future more than we hate our past. Okay. And that requires us to move away the pieces on the table that are clogging up the communication and trust which needs to come into business between business, government, business and labor, and so on. And that will only come when we have common purpose and we all go, we understand why we're doing this, we understand why we're holding hands, we understand the differences, and we're going to share the spoils.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just welcome Miesha, who joins us on the line. Miesha, good morning.
Morning, Lukona. And by the way, you got one of my favorite guys. I love his brain when it comes to business.
Is it? No, I'm glad I have made the pause for you this morning, Miesha.
You stay them every week, brother. Fantastic. Mr. Barnes, I like it, and I like your ideas. But this is what I've got. Lukona, I think our capital in South Africa is too dormant. It is too static. It is too old-fashioned. It is not transformative because our capital buys into a product, not into an idea. I can give you one example. What would have happened to Elon Musk if he stayed in South Africa? He would have become a motor mechanic.
Mm.
But he went to a place where an idea is far more important than a product. And he found people there who are open-minded with a lot of capital, venture capitalists, whether Sequoia, whether InterCapital or whatever, who would say, I like this young man's idea, I could buy. Look at the man. He has transformed the world and the United States of America.
Mm.
And those are the benefits that I think people like Mark, for example, when they have people who've got the capital, who've got the mind for business, can they open up their mind and say, let's listen to people who've got ideas. You're going to listen. The biggest, one of the companies that ever came in the last 20, 30 years is Capitec Bank.
Mm.
I don't think the guys in Stellenbosch knew that there can be 12 million black people who are not bankable, who you could touch. There was some guy who somebody was able to listen to when he said, by the way, there is this idea. There are 12 million people. So that's what I'm saying. And this person bought into the idea, listened to it, and look what Capitec has acquired.
Nah.
One of the biggest banks in this country.
Absolutely.
So I'm saying to Mark, can he be that kind of people when he's with his friends, we like it or not, capital is white in South Africa, and it still is that way. These are the people who, when they come together, they can say, by the way, can we open the door for that kind of guy, which we don't know, who came to this guy's Stellenbosch and say, we can start a bank like Capitec? Can Mark be those kind of people where we have flexible capital, capital that moves, capital that's able to buy into ideas, not products? And this is what this country needs, because in this country, we are not like the United States where you have to create problems and solve them. We have a myriad of problems here, and we've got people who can solve them. They need the capital. Can Mark be that?
Miesha, thank you very much. Mark, can you be that person? I mean, the point Miesha is raising, I mean, these were some of the thinkings Michael Jordan had as well when he was leaving F&B to sort of, try and see how do you back ideas rather than just products and create the space. I mean, your comments there to Miesha, Mark.
Yes, sir. You've got the enthusiasm. I think you can do it. You don't need me, huh?
He needs the money, Mark, and he says, well, now you are in the money.
Yeah, okay. I what we need is that the centers of power and the centers of capital need to get onto the same side of the table.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, that's the first thing you need to do. I think that, you know, I think it's going to happen. I think that it's going to become so clear that to build another building in Sandton or in the waterfront is not going to give you the return on capital, because you should rather invest that in your future clients.
Yeah.
So I think it is starting to happen. But the trouble with lazy, fat capital is that it doesn't need to move. It just sits still.
Yeah.
Not realizing that it's plotting its own demise. So I'm fully supportive of you. And yes, you look at the Capitec model. What a fabulous story. By the way, it didn't happen overnight.
Mm.
It took 20 years or more for that thing to manifest. Okay. And what's happening essentially is that people are moving away from traditional analysis. They're moving away from traditional risk return analysis, moving out of the constructs of asset-based lending, moving out of the construct of covenant-driven limits to access to capital, to starting to understand a very different economy, which was very separate from the economy in which traditional capital grew up. We just have to keep hitting that drum, and eventually the capital will start pouring away from stale, established capital markets into more adventurous, exploits of people who are actually doing things every day.
No.
I think it's going to happen. I think it's happening naturally. I think, to talk to a company I'm involved in, Easy Equities, we've got 800,000 new investors. We've got more young investors in the stock market on Easy Equity than were on the JSE when we started.
Mm.
Okay? Because people are being given incremental access, understandable, consumable, edible access. And for the first time, and this is a very important point, most people never accumulate assets. They service their liabilities and then hand over the house when they go. Okay? So we need for people to have assets so that they have something to look after.
Mm.
And so we've got to take that risk. But you can't take that risk at the wrong price. And that's what's happening. Capital is flowing into the informal economy, but it's such a punitive price that credit has become destructive to growth, not enabling. And I'm seeing a change. There was an impact fund launched yesterday, I think it was, on Business Day Television. People are starting to talk about impact capital. The measurement of the outcome of impact capital is not just returns. It's returns plus jobs plus other metrics, which start creating a resilient middle class. It's happening. It is happening. I hope you have something to do with it.
Absolutely. Mark, I mean, on a lighter side of note, talking about risks, I wonder what you said about 10 years ago as to, you know, how you started a rose garden so that it could help you with women. It was a worthy risk, and your charming streak in that interview with Fin24 in 2011 has developed.
You have to bring up the past. I thought you were moving on from the past.
We were loving the future, Mark.
Yeah.
But I mean, one of the other things you are into is, art collection. And I've often wondered why we haven't seen a takeoff in terms of backing arts, particularly in the rural and township areas, as part of economic development and ensuring that, you know, that talent and skill that people develop in their own right, particularly because in those areas, we also lament that the educational outcomes are not so good. And this could assist us, you know, with joblessness and people not being part of the productive economy. Have you thought about how we can probably plug into that art space in those areas?
Yeah, you know, I think it's happening more than you give it credit for, Bukuna. Mm. I mean, I think young emerging black artists are very cool. You know, it's very cool. I've got young black artist art hanging in my house, and some of it has become increasingly valuable over the years. I think the minds are opening away from what you might call, you know, traditional old art, traditional old culture, simply by force of numbers.
Okay? Yep.
We are not, a small island that belongs to some colonial, but we are South Africa. Okay, and I would argue that if you had enabling market forces, that the economic, and if you released restrictions, that the economic outcome would mirror the demographic profile of South Africa without intervention. Mm. It eventually has to. That's how it is. It's a weight. So, for example, you take collective funding schemes and these sorts of things. You take the innovators that get venture capital and so on. Eventually, that force prevails.
Yeah.
Okay. And people, if they want to stay in the game, have to change their minds on capital, okay, and have to put it where the growth is. And so I think it's happening more than we'd like, to admit, or not fast enough, but it's out there. It's happening. People are thinking differently. My children, and I've got grown-up children, I didn't want to mention my age, they don't see the stuff that we see as impediments.
Yeah. And I think that's a very important thing. I mean, Maka did promise, to you that, the post office stuff is the old stuff. So, as you said, let's love the future more than the past. But I'm sure, this particular question, though, I can't let you go without having had a bite on it. I mean, this is an institution with such great promise and potential. As you said, you are mandated to make sure everybody has an address across the country. So your footprint is quite significant. But it seems as if it's an institution that's been quite lethargic in terms of its uptake on technology. I mean, when people talk about a state bank, I often think my first bank account was with the Post Bank, that book that I had, and it would have to go to Bloemfontein for auditing. I don't know why Bloemfontein, but then it would come back and they would have minus.
There's nothing else to do in Bloemfontein.
So, Mark, I mean, this institution called the Post Office, why has it lost on its potential so much that some of my friends are receiving their Christmas cards only this week?
Well, you know, the good news is that you're going to get Christmas cards more than once a year. So that's something to look forward to. No, I think, first of all, I think, the Post Office of the future is not the Post Office of the past.
Yeah.
The Post Office is a commercially irreplaceable footprint with certain government privileges and obligations. Okay, we have to, as you say, we have to provide addresses. We have to deliver a post where it's not commercially viable. And the payoff profile of that is that we get certain rights of delivery and so on, like we can clear customs at the airport or whatever it might be. But we have to go well beyond, like the rest of the world has, well beyond thinking, of a post office as a place where you go and collect your letters. It's not. Every single cubicle in a post office, if you like, every single counter is a channel between government, because it's a state-owned entity, and the peoples of South Africa. And the footprint is widely dispersed. You should be able to go into a post office, to collect posts, to get your e-commerce delivered, to get your to pay your whatever accounts you've got, to receive money, to disperse antiretroviral medicines, to get your passport, to get all of those kinds of things backed by a central government computer. But all of that requires access to the national payment system for the settlement of these things, which is why the post office has to move away from being a physical post office to being an integrated, technologically driven data company. South African Post Office has got one of the best sets of data in the country. We've got everyone's address. We've got everyone's. We've got depositors. We've got social grant beneficiaries. We've got a relationship we can develop with Home Affairs and so on. If you think of the successful companies in the world, they've been data companies.
Yeah.
Okay, people that have utilized their data to grow businesses. And so we need to liberate our minds about what it could be. We need, I think, to cross the barrier into a private-public partnership. Because we need to change the way one thinks about these assets and things, and it's and technology has to be the pervasive communication. But it is, in my view, still the most valuable branch network in South Africa. And if they get it, if you take this last year, if the post office had been fully functional, it was a deliveries paradise. Everyone was delivering everything. Okay?
Yeah.
All the courier companies were booming. Everyone was delivering. I mean, that should have been our home. That should have been what we embraced. It's no use talking backwards, but I don't think it's over.
Yeah.
I think the post office can become a central organism that could reach out to the rural areas and brings commerce into the main center. So I love the place, man. I love the people.
You still seem like you miss it, Mark. On that note, Thank you so much for making the time on this open conversation here on Power Talk.
All right. I'm delighted that you had interest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. That is, of course, Mark Barnes, former CEO at the South African Post Office.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.